You okay back there?
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. So this is our second day of the retreat on compassion. And yesterday, I considered, or we talked a little bit about, what is compassion from a Buddhist perspective? And for those who weren't here, I'd just like to say a quote from one person, Dr. Thumpten Jumpa, a Tibetan scholar and translator for the Dalai Lama. And he's now works a lot on compassion in a research way, as well as teaching compassion around. And I like his basic summary of what compassion is from a Buddhist point of view. And this is what he wrote. He said, broadly defined, compassion is a sense of concern that arises when we're confronted with another's suffering and feel motivated to see that suffering relieved. Compassion is a response to the inevitable reality of our human condition, our experience of pain and sorrow, and offers the possibility of responding with understanding, kindness, and patience. And notice he doesn't say fix. He just says to respond. Compassion arises out of our deepest nature. It arises from our interconnectedness with each other and with all things. But, you know, it's not just a Buddhist understanding either. I think this is perhaps, when we really consider what compassion is, it touches many different cultures and ways of understanding. There's a passage that I read recently by Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. And I think this passage expresses it quite well in a very different way. He wrote, in Africa, when you see someone, you say, how are you? And the reply you usually get is in the plural, even when you're speaking just to one person. A man would say, we are well, or we are not well. And he himself may be quite well, but his grandmother is not well, and so he is not well either. The solitary, isolated human being is really a contradiction in terms. That's from Desmond Tutu. So I like that a lot. So next time Kate has a cold, I'm going to say, we are not well. We are not well. Because that's the truth. At times in our life, compassion may call for, you know, powerful gestures of openness and sacrifice, because so great will be the need. But mostly compassion will ask for simply a presence. Maybe even a profound presence with the commitment to face and deal with the sorrow and troubles of a friend, a stranger, family member of the world. Compassion will ask us to bring ease into the world with a kind word, a hug, a moment when we stop listening to our own fears and reactions and listen instead to the cries around us. Now, words can be pretty tricky. So I'd like to briefly mention two words that are kind of close to compassion, but I think are different, and that's pity and empathy. Now, pity is sometimes called the poor cousin of compassion. The feeling of pity includes a sense of kind of remoteness, I think. A sense of sadness and sorry, but not any reaching out. Pity arises when the heart is blocked, I think, with fear. In pity, you don't see yourself in another. You're just glad you're not that other. I think the fear is, if we get too close, if we allow the heart to open fully, we may be overwhelmed and be devastated. And so we keep a distance that's protective, and the distance that also kind of absolves us from engaging. And yet pity is a natural response from our own conditioning. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's just something I think we should recognize when it arises in us. See it what it is, and then we can ask ourselves, can I go a little further? Can I respond? And, you know, even feeling a fear, can I still respond? So that's pity. At least kind of my kind of thoughts on pity at the moment. Empathy, unlike pity, does not stand at a distance from the suffering of the world. It dissolves that barrier between you and the suffering heart of another. But with just empathy, we can get lost in those kind of fires of anguish, those fires of suffering that the person is experiencing. And sometimes we're unable to really stay grounded with any sense of equanimity, and so we're unable to act skillfully. That's kind of my feeling of empathy. It makes it a little different than compassion. And not that empathy is bad either. It's just we need to ask ourselves, you know, again, you know, can I respond and not get lost in the suffering of this other person? So what these words actually mean to you and how you use them maybe is going to be a bit different than my kind of thoughts on them. But I think we can all accept that along with a heart that is vulnerable to the sufferings of this world, we do need the capacity to act. Even if that act is simply to remain present. Acts of compassion are transformative. They comfort the afflicted, and they open the heart of the actor. Acts of compassion, whether we're the receiver or we're the giver, awaken. And of course, this is all done only in the present. How will you meet this person before you? How will you meet yourself at this moment in that situation? Compassion, I've noticed in myself, you know, arises pretty easily when a friend receives a diagnosis that's pretty serious, or we meet someone who's kind of, you know, lost child, for example, someone that we can connect with quite quickly. But how is it when you meet the unwashed street person who asks for more change after you've dropped a few coins in his plastic container? I had an interesting experience a while ago giving someone some change and the person saying, "Do you have any more? Do you have any more?" How is it when someone bumps into you and rushes off with a careless sorry tossed over their shoulder because they're so busy? How is it when the muscle car speeds past you and then the driver flips you the finger because you weren't going fast enough? I believe that to nurture a heart without boundaries, to cultivate a deep compassion is not just soft and limited, or heart that's not just soft and limited. It really, to cultivate deep compassion requires courage and understanding of our own boundaries, and an understanding of the boundlessness of life itself. Our story is both personal and universal at the same time. So let's shift our focus a little bit. Let's talk about the most important person in the room, which is you. The Udana, the third book in a collection of early Buddhist texts known as the Kudaka Nikaya, this little book offers a kind of a rich collection of really short teachings of the Buddha. And each one of these teachings usually accumulates in a small verse that is uttered by the Buddha, kind of summarizing what he's about to say or what he has just said. And one of those verses goes like this. Searching all directions with your awareness, you will find no one dearer than yourself. When I read that a long time ago, first time I read that, I thought, nah. But while there's truth in that, it's also true many of us consider ourselves at times the most undeserving of any human being that walks on this earth. The loud, critical voice that lives inside many of us often does not allow for forgiveness and compassion. And yet, without a ground of self-compassion and forgiveness, well, where can we stand? Pema Chodron, the American teacher in the Tibetan tradition, has written a number of books, a very interesting teacher. And she wrote this about compassion. In order to have compassion for others, we have to have compassion for ourselves. In order to have compassion for ourselves, we have to have compassion for ourselves. In particular, to care about other people who are angry, fearful, jealous, overcome by addictions of all kinds, arrogant, proud, miserly, selfish, mean, you can go on, I'm sure. To have compassion and care for these people means not to run away from the pain of finding these things in ourselves. Now, I don't know about you, but when I find those things in myself, don't you kind of want to run away? One way or another. Apparently, in 1989, at one of the first kind of international Buddhist teachers' conferences, these conferences had been kind of convened by the Dalai Lama in those years. And at this conference in 89, the Dalai Lama learned for the first time about the extent of unworthiness and self-criticism and shame and even self-hatred that many feel who have grown up in Western societies. He was really shocked, and he could not believe what Western Buddhist teachers were telling him about the condition of students and even of themselves as they were practicing. He could not believe what he was hearing at first. And, of course, it's true, isn't it? Many of us, while trying to be good underneath, really see ourselves as unworthy, lacking, blameworthy, flawed in some way. And maybe there's even a sense that we are unlovable, unforgivable. Maybe that arises sometimes. And even our practice, you know, sitting here on the cushion, can be a source of feeding the critical voice, right? Not good enough, Michael. There are times in my practice of meditation, and also when I was doing martial arts, when I strived to achieve a kind of faultlessness or perfection that I saw was missing and yet necessary in my life. It's quite interesting, you know, in martial arts, you know, you practice and practice and practice, and you're trying to get it right. You know, be able to throw those people around and not hurt them. But of course, faultlessness never appeared. And treating my practice as another self-improvement project had merely transferred my lifelong patterns of unworthiness and criticism onto the practice itself. Pretty easy to do. And something we need to see clearly and put down. This is why Dokusan is so helpful. Right? People come in and say, oh, I can't do it, Michael, I can't do it. The tyranny of self-improvement was always present beside me on the cushion and in the dojo. And it is a tyranny. The strong, persistent voice of critical judgment really leaves little space for, you know, self-compassion. And isn't it true for all of us? To whatever extent, our own self-obsession and self-denial both lead into kind of sharp brambles and dark places. So consider for a moment, for example, how much you think about the parts of your personality, your body and mind that you wish you could change. And then compare that to how much of the time you spend thinking and appreciating the good aspects of yourself. I think that's a key for us. That the greatest barrier to finding compassion and forgiveness for ourselves is not in the unskillful words and actions that we have done. Rather, it's in the denial of what is human and fragile within us. We don't want that stuff. And yet that is exactly what we need to hold tenderly. So my stories, and maybe yours kind of goes like this. Yes, we all make mistakes, except mine are unforgivable. Yes, we all act unskillful at times, but my faults are the greatest. Yes, we all get caught in anger, greed, or lust. Except I'm a monster for having gotten lost in it. So in this way, we judge ourselves as alone, as separate. And compassion reminds us that is not true. Compassion reminds us that we do belong, that we have always belonged. Compassion does not ask us to abandon anyone or anything, not even our painful, harsh judgments. It asks us instead to become truly intimate with them, to see them what they are. compassion kind of shuffles up to pain and suffering. It's willing to be there with the uncomfortable and not bolt out the door. So the practice of compassion, I think, creates a willingness to be steadfast and present in those dark places. And in doing so, giving the gift of possibility, meaning the stories that we have so long been entangled up in are not complete, not true, but there's much more there. We just have to be there and see it clearly. So how do we practice? Well, I guess there's lots of ways. At first, we can make a commitment of nonviolence toward our own heart and mind and body, right? I can't tell you as a young man how many times I looked in the mirror at my head, lamenting the hairline receding backwards and more and more and more. So can we make a commitment of nonviolence to put those stories down? One of the practices of the Eightfold Path is, of course, right intention. We recognize when our thoughts and intentions are unwholesome, and we work to abandon them. We set the intention. I will put this unwholesome thought down when it arises. I will not engage in it. I will think of a wholesome thought instead. So when we notice ourselves with unwholesome intentions, such as ill will or harmfulness, we practice seeing it clearly, kind of right view, another one of the Eightfold Path. We see it as conditioning from our past, recognizing that it's causing us suffering, and probably suffering of the people closest to us as well. You know, who wants to be around a young man who's always worried about his hairline, you know, or caught up in, you know, lamenting that whatever it is. And then we take steps to correct it. We make right effort. We try to replace it. When we practice sitting with our discomfort, stepping back from the story of our worthlessness or inadequacy, a space arises. And there we can invoke compassion. This too, this thought, this feeling, this too. This is a moment of suffering. This is a part of human life. And gradually, you know, letting go as much as we can of critical judgment, we open just to acceptance. This human life of mine has cracks. And these cracks, although each one is personal and painful, have an ancient twisted history that go far beyond anything I can control or influence. As Leonard Cohen sang in Anthem, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. This acceptance, it really is really far from resignation. It's just the tender recognition of our own imperfection. In this practice that we do, You're always called to know yourself. For it's in knowing the rage, despair, sorrow, grief, shame, and the heart that allows you to be present with others in their rage, despair, sorrow, grief, and shame. And of course, we're also called to know our joy, delight, wisdom, and love. Letting go of the stories, we become intimate with ourselves. We really become intimate to know ourselves deeply. Nothing is left out. A strong compassion is born out of acceptance and respect for ourselves. And then this touches others. And listening deeply to ourselves, we're able to listen deeply to others. As Pema Chodron wrote, remember, in order to have compassion for others, we have to have compassion for ourselves. So the ground for a kind of healthy, strong compassion towards others is established with a tender knowing of our own capacities, our fears, doubts, of our own integrity. So, heart work, I titled this weekend, right? This is the work of the heart, the work that leads us directly into conflict and the suffering of life that we have so long tried to avoid. And you notice I didn't put that on the title, right? This will lead us into the... But it's true. So after we've set our intentions, we sit courageously with our pain, our painful emotions, our thoughts. And it's helpful to acknowledge, you know, when they arise, that these are not yours alone. That they are manifestations of the universal experience that we all share of pain and loss. They're simply part of what it means to be human, to have a body, to have a heart, to have a mind. A body, heart, and mind that are cracked and flawed. So in this way, I think in our practice, looking deeply at our life, it really becomes clear how little control we have. In our repentance verse, we chant, you know, all my ancient twisted karma from beginning this greed, hate, and delusion born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. But Kate came up with a much better version. And she said, all our ancient twisted karma. All our ancient twisted karma. Because that's truer. And that's the truth. From our conception to this moment, countless forces, causes, and conditions have shaped each of us. Most of them far beyond our control. I mean, we didn't even get to choose who our parents were. The first thing, you know, that we thought, okay, we want the best parents. Not even that. As Zokitsu Norman Fisher, the guiding teacher, no, the founding teacher of Mountain Ring, he said in so many words, your life is not your fault. Your life is not your fault. It is, though, your responsibility. In other words, we've each been given a body, a heart, mind, molded, shaped, wounded, and twisted in various ways that were never of our choosing. Looking for a better past, kind of lamenting, right? If only my parents had. If only my teachers had. If only that lamenting or longing for a better past, of course, is a waste of time and a waste of life. The questions that are always before us are, how shall I live? As what kind of person? Compassion hears the cries of the world, and you are part of this world. There's no way, nor perhaps I should say, there's no set way to practice compassion, whether for oneself or for others. But I think compassion begins usually with a listening, a willingness to attend to ourselves and to others. And then, having listened carefully, we extend our hands with whatever action may be helpful, not knowing if it truly will be helpful or not. And sometimes that extending of hands is simply to sit quietly and listen more. Compassion is like the bamboo blowing in the wind or weighted down with snow. It bends with the situation. It flexes depending on what's called for. What does your life call for right now? Can you put down those half-truths that you believe about yourself, those twisted stories, and just be with the joys and the sorrows of your life? Can you see that young girl and the young boy still inside, calling for your compassionate care? As we did last time, I'd like to end with a kind of a short meditation. I'm going to introduce another little kind of compassion meditation. So if you just want to make yourselves comfortable taking a meditation posture. Just begin as we always begin, by just noticing how your body feels. And just as with as much intention and tenderness that you have at this moment, just have a sense of compassion for yourself. Knowing you are an imperfect being, as everyone else is. And in this practice, we're going to use four or so short phrases with the intention of resting in that compassion for ourselves, just as much as we can without pushing or forcing. And gently on the out-breath, may my sorrow and pain be eased. And may I be at peace. May I be kind to myself. May I accept myself as I am. May my pain and sorrow be eased. May I be at peace. May I be kind to myself. May I accept myself as I am. May my pain and sorrow be eased. May I be at peace. May I be kind to myself. May I accept myself as I am.